Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that explores the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Greta Anderson, together with Gail Seiler. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Greta, and hello to you, the listener.
It's Monday, and we're going to do our best to get you ready for the week ahead. There is lots going on in Ames and lots going on in our show today.
Later in the hour, we'll be joined by author Franz Schreier, who is in town as part of the ISU lecture series, and we'll be talking about his book, They Never Came Back, a story of undocumented workers from Mexico.
Gail, I understand you've taken a look at that book.
Yes, I was able to get an e-copy of it last week and found it a fascinating book to read over the weekend. The author, Dr. Schreier, is an anthropologist, so there are many human stories, but he also takes a policy perspective and considers immigration and economic policies.
Well, that sounds interesting. And in a bit, we'll hear from a local videographer who just won a Best in Show award at the Best of the Midwest Video Fest. This video is about the move of the Ames Library out of its current location into a temporary location and back to the renewed building at 515 Douglas Avenue. I know from experience that was an epic story.
Right. Your husband works at the library, and so he must have played a big part in that and been very involved.
Yes, I can say that our household ate, slept, and breathed library details for much of these past 2 years. Starting off our show, we have in the studio Linda Hansen. Linda is the clinic director for primary health care, a relative newcomer to the Story County health care scene, but one sorely needed as it serves low-income clients, those on Medicare, those without insurance, or for that matter, documentation, and also those who have accrued such large medical debts that they have trouble getting through the door at other institutions.
Primary health care opened shop in a small building across from McFarland Clinic in Ames last January. This week, they are unveiling their new quarters in West Ames on Lincoln Way near Franklin Street.
That open house is this Thursday from 5 to 6:30. Linda, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us why you're excited about showing off primary health care's new digs. What makes this new facility better for you and your clients?
Well, for one thing, it's much larger. So our waiting room at our new place was about the size of our previous clinic across from McFarland. It was a nice temporary location, but we're really happy to have adequate space to treat our patients. We also have a lot more room for exam rooms. We have 12 exam rooms and a procedure room now instead of just the 4 we had before.
And what kinds of cases would be typical that you see or you expect to see?
Well, we have just general family practice, but then we also see some sort of unique clients. We have had some patients who are recent refugees, and through the Refugee Committee of Iowa, we see and do their physicals, for example. We also have a certified nurse midwife. And so she provides prenatal care to people who are pregnant and don't have insurance. So we see a lot of pregnant women. And then just general family practice as well.
And maybe is there a less typical kind of case that stands out as demonstrating your mission and kind of a unique, interesting case?
Sure. I think the most challenging clients that we've served are probably our homeless clients, because it's very hard to manage your health care if you're homeless. And so we try to go beyond just providing for their health care. We look at their living situation, and we work with a homeless shelter here in town, and then primary health care also has a homeless advocacy program in Des Moines that we've interacted with, because it's really hard to get medically stable. So I think our patients who are homeless and have chronic problems like diabetes and are trying to manage that, those are the most challenging ones.
And how does a client or a patient qualify? Is it free? Is there a nominal fee or a sliding scale? And what do people have to provide in order to qualify to be seen?
Well, we'll see anybody who walks through the door. So that's part of the requirements for being a community health center, which is what our designation is. But we receive federal funding to meet unmet needs of people who are without insurance or who have or underinsured. So to meet those qualifications, all our clients will meet with our benefit specialist, and she can tell them whether or not they qualify to be on our sliding fee scale. You have to be below 200% of the federal poverty level. And if you qualify by bringing in your pay stubs for the last couple months or your taxes for the last year, then the fee for the visit is $20, and that includes lab and some x-ray as well. If you don't qualify and you're still uninsured, then the same day fee is $60. So it's still much lower cost. And then anybody can come with any kind of insurance, and we'll bill your insurance and see you just like any other clinic.
Okay, so this is a great new resource for people's health in Ames.
That's right. We used to have a free clinic down at the Methodist Church. You said they were instrumental in bringing primary health care here.
Yeah, the free clinic was an amazing service that was provided here for many years and met a lot of needs. Unfortunately, it was, because it was volunteer driven, it was only available one night a week. And so particularly Mary Kitchell and others who were very instrumental in working to get a more permanent clinic to meet needs, along with McFarland and Mary Greeley. So primary health care was actually invited by the community, and including the healthcare community, to come to Ames, recognizing this unmet need. And so now we're able to provide the privacy of a clinic and lab equipment and all the things that you need to really provide a better quality care. So while we appreciate the roots of having come from the free clinic, we feel like we're in a much better situation to serve people's needs now.
And primary health care had already been established in Des Moines with a few clinics there, and you set up one in Marshalltown. This is a nonprofit that serves people without insurance, is expanding now, even in the era of Obamacare, when people are supposed to have more insurance. Can you explain the relationship there?
Sure. Yes, we do have three clinics in Des Moines, and we work with the Mercy Residency Program in Des Moines and a pharmacy in Des Moines, and we have a dental clinic in Des Moines and then a dental clinic and medical clinic in Marshalltown. And with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, what we have seen is that our patients, a much higher percentage now, qualify for Medicaid. So about half our patients now are on Medicaid, which was more like 30% before. So the Affordable Care Act has helped. I think the other thing that we do for people who are low income is that we use an integrated model of health care. And so we have on staff a nurse care manager, a family support worker, and a behavioral health consultant. Those three positions help people who are living in poverty. So our family support worker will help our clients access community resources, help them to know where to find diapers in town or where to get daycare or how to sign up for disability. Our nurse care manager manages people with chronic conditions to keep them out of the hospital. And our behavioral health consultant is an on-site social worker that can provide short-term counseling and intervention for people with mental illness, living with family violence, and those kind of situations. So it's a little bit different model of care that really speaks to the needs of people living with poverty.
That's very interesting. Are your clients just from Ames or from the larger region? Do they come in to visit?
The great majority so far are from Ames. We'll serve anybody, of course. But I think probably because of transportation issues, getting to our clinic from outlying communities is a little bit difficult. But we're happy to see anybody.
And do you see minors? So, for example, can teenagers come for health care, or how does that work?
Sure, you bet. We can see we see children, we see teenagers, college students.
Okay.
Yes.
I was curious whether you have seen clients who signed up through the exchange, the Affordable Care Act exchange for Co-Opportunity Health, which, of course, was one of the only two healthcare providers that accepted patients on subsidized health care, and now it's defunct. So all those low-income people who had signed up for Co-Opportunity Health, I've been wondering about them and how they're getting health care. Have you seen that population?
We do see that population. Unfortunately, that's not my specialty area, so I would you'll have to invite Melody back. She's our benefit specialist. I don't know that. I know that we have those patients, and I know that that is going away. That insurance company is gone now, right?
Yeah.
I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think we want to remind our listeners again that there will be an open house, and that is on Thursday from 5 to 6:30. And can you say the address again?
It's 3510 West Lincoln Way. So we're right across from May House Chinese and in front of Lincoln Apartments, a big brick building there.
Okay, and close to public transportation, and so it's an accessible location.
There's a bus stop right in front of us. So.
Okay, that's great. Anything else you want to tell people about that we haven't mentioned?
No, just if you have unmet healthcare needs and you need a place to go, we'd be happy to see you and hope to see everybody at our open house on Thursday.
Okay, well, that's a wonderful resource. Thank you very much. It's good to know that a place like this exists in Ames and is expanding to meet people's needs in Ames. So thanks for telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We turn now to a City of Ames employee who was recently awarded Best in Show for his work in a creative vein. Best in Show, are you the handler or the one being put through his paces?
Yes.
Ha ha. We're kidding, of course. Derek, who is the City of Ames cable TV manager, won Best in Show in the Best of the Midwest Video Fest for his 15-minute video about the Ames Public Library move. Thank you for coming in today, Derek.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's listen to the opening riff of Ames Public Library, a great story.
What makes a great story? Is it the plot? The characters? Maybe the setting? Does it need to be short or long? Filled with tension or suspense? The Ames Public Library is filled with great stories. In books, both big and small, in movies, digital media, and the patrons. Your interactions with those around you and the situation. For ages 1 to 100, you will find a story here. But who wants to start at the end of a story? If you do want to start at the end, you know what happens. The library opened. But that's not the whole story.
Derek, that was a very catchy opening, and it ties in with the title, Ames Public Library, A Great Story, and with the closing statement, which we'll hear in a bit. What made the move and the renewal of the Ames Public Library a story you wanted to tell?
Well, as you know, the library is a great place, and they have great employees, and it's just a wonderful environment to be in. And I started my career here at the city 6 years ago, and one of the first videos I did was a space needs study when they were first looking at the expansion. And I thought, you know, if they ever do this, it'd be kind of fun to follow the story all the way through. And I was fortunate enough to get in at that beginning point and started gathering video, meeting people, and kind of getting an idea, and started this documentary, you know, 4 years ago when they started the move. Had a couple of interviews and followed them all through the initial move out. Did a short little video piece of the move out too. And then just as the years went on, collected all the footage and kind of tried to collaborate a story that would really kind of highlight what they did. Because to me, it was impressive that they're librarians. I mean, by trade, that's what they do. That's what they study. But they moved a library. I mean, they're like professional movers now too. So they should put that on their resume as well.
Yeah, that's was really interesting in watching it. I'm new to Ames, so I don't know the whole story behind the library and its renewal and the move. And I was surprised to see that staff and volunteers basically moved the library, the books, the shelving, the furniture, everything. It's amazing. Was this video something that was commissioned by the city or the library, or is it something you decided to do on your own, and how did you fund it?
It was my idea, and I talked to Lynn Carey and asked, you know, what she thought of
the library director.
Yeah, the library director, Lynn Carey, and said, here's kind of what I would like to do. And, I mean, they were great. Couldn't have done this video without the entire library staff. I mean, they basically had a cameraman, myself, and a couple of my production interns following them around for 3 years, 4 years, whenever they're moving, whenever they're having moving meetings, sticking the camera in their face. And very much like local celebrities. And they put up with it pretty well. And towards the end of it, I was even happy that they stopped looking at the camera, because I always tell them that. I was like, don't look at the camera, just pretend I'm not here. And, you know, I'm walking around with sometimes big gear on and all that kind of stuff, rather distracting, but they kind of got used to me. As far as the funding goes, the Government Access Channel, Channel 12, is funded through the cable franchise fee. And so if you have a cable bill, part of that bill comes and funds the Government Access Channel. And the Ames Public Library is part of the city government services. And so the entire funding for that came from that fund.
Wow, that's cool. Is this the first video documentary you have made?
Yes, yes it is. It was, you know, I'm already started to work on my second one. The water treatment plant is building a new plant. So
oh, no.
That'll be another multi-year project. But this was the first one, feature-length documentary that I did. I do a lot of different stories. I mean, we do shows with the library. We have a couple of recurring series over there. And we do short PSAs, but this was a longer documentary featured. And the length of it was something that I was particularly concerned with. Like the script that we heard there at the beginning, you know, I went back and forth over, you know, how long should this be? I had like over 84 hours worth of footage. And just I could tell that story in like five or six different ways. And I really tried to focus in on the library staff and just the impressive job that they did. And I wanted to keep it short enough that just the average viewer coming across it would be entertained and watch it. Because with documentaries that I've seen, a lot of times, you know, they can be a good story, but sometimes they can drag on. The pacing can kind of get too much, where even if it's interesting or it's not really something that you would normally watch, you know, after 10, 20, 30 minutes, you're like, okay, I don't have time for this. And, you know, I figured 16 minutes was just enough to kind of tell the entire story, highlighting the impressive work that was done, but not boring just the average viewer.
So like in planning a book or writing a book, you have a lot of ways to approach it. You can focus on the plot, the characters, the context or setting. And you're saying you chose to focus on the people, on the characters. Could you say more about that thinking process and how you worked from that to construct the video?
Well, ideally, you'd like to have a script written before you start work on a documentary, and I did not. I just started filming. And as I went along, I had these ideas and I'd kind of jot them down about, okay, here's something that I want to highlight. Here's something that I want to highlight. This would be a great story. You know, this is interesting, that kind of thing. But the script was a struggle. I mean, I kind of set myself up for intense scrutiny by talking about a great story with librarians. I mean, they read great stories all the time. And actually my initial line of questioning for some of those interview pieces that came in there, like four or five of the questions that I asked didn't make it into the documentary because I changed veins kind of late in the show with how I was going to go. And ultimately for me it came down to the pacing. How could I tell the story? What were my sound bites that were going to support the story and the footage? I mean, I had enough footage to tell anything, but what was going to pull it all together really well? And I went through like five or six final versions with kind of different scripts and different endings before I kind of finally honed in on what became the eventual video. And the part that I like to tell is there's a little montage in the middle about the construction work, and the construction obviously was a big part of it. And in my first cut, I didn't have anything on the construction in the final. I was like, there's no way I can have all this video of all the work that they did with constructing the actual library and not show any of it. So after the first cut, I went back and kind of put that little piece in there and got that in there. And I was really quite pleased with how it came together in the end.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that there was footage of the construction. So you had to get in there with hard hat, I imagine, and
yep,
and be in with the crew as they were building.
Yeah. And that was, you know, it was very interesting to see it taken all the way down to the bare bones and then built back up. And so that was putting all that work into it. I guess you don't want to let that influence your final piece of being like, well, this was a lot of work that I did, so it has to go in the video. But there was, I think, an interesting component to the story, and we shortened it enough, I think like 35 seconds, that it showed a lot. And there's a lot of interesting construction footage, and I learned a lot about construction mm-hmm. and constructing a library. And again, you know, back to the library staff about they're trained librarians, but they're having to make all these construction decisions. And, I mean, they really threw themselves into the project 100%. And, I mean, they understand a lot more about construction now, I imagine, than they did 4 years ago. And they're really proud, and they should be, of what has become the Ames Public Library.
We're talking with Derek Chrysler, who received an award for his 16-minute video about the Ames Public Library's move and renewal. One of the interesting kind of more librarian-esque stories that's told is the story of Seth, everyone was kind of in awe of him for a while. My husband was saying he's a genius, you know, because he had figured out how to predict how many books would go on a shelf or something like that.
Yeah, they had what they called waypoints, and he plotted out the entire collection. So every genre that they had to go through and on paper write down how many shelves it would need for them to fit this collection here and how much floor space they had. And, I mean, that's really kind of the start to what became the library and how it came across. And I knew right away that it's like, I need to feature Seth in this because, like you said, everybody was just amazed at what he did. And on the move team, they had several different teams, the move team, the furniture team. And there's an interesting piece in the video about Seth talking about one of his favorite things to do was to go out and try out all the new furniture, too. But it really was impressive just to see how he was able to put that together as well. I mean, because that's the basis of it, and how the rest of it all comes together is all based on what he was able to put in his mind on paper for everybody else to understand.
Yeah, and that's a really good example of how the librarians and staff had to step out of their normal roles and kind of use different parts of their brain, conceptualize what was going to happen in the new space, and make it happen.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the sounds. In the segment that we heard in the beginning, there obviously was narration, there was music, and there was also just like kind of background noise. I guess it was people coming and going and cheering and so on. And as a medium, the radio, we're always making decisions about music and background, foreground, and so on. And so could you just talk a minute about the sounds and how you made those kinds of decisions?
In video production, sound is very important as well. You know, I'll tell a lot of before I came here, I was an interim instructor at Pittsburgh State University and teaching video production classes. And I was always tell my students, and I tell my production assistants now, that people can put up with bad video, but they won't put up with bad sound. And so if you have anything that sounds terrible, you'd be like, I don't want to listen to this. You'll turn away, you'll turn it down, and you'll tune out. You'll lose the audience. And I'm always saying you got to keep the nat sound, but you got to find that even level of a lot of stuff. So in that little piece that we listened to begin with, I mean, there was a lot that we showed. We showed some construction footage. We showed a shot of me surprising one of the librarians, and then the grand opening. And the cheering that you heard was the grand opening of the library. Mm-hmm. And it kind of comes full circle. We come back to that at the end with the cheering and the opening of the library and the telling of the story. But the sound is something that whenever I'm out recording video, I'm very mindful of the sound because, you know, silence speaks volumes. The little bits of construction work can really add, you know, texture to the video or draw the audience in or turn them away. So you have to be very specific and considerate in what you use with that.
I'm seeing the video now again in my head and hearing it in a new way. I did think you dealt with the opening of the library, that footage, which was really the climax of the story, in a really compelling way. The opening back in September of last year was a very emotional day for the team. My husband, Mark Harris, as the IT services guy over there, was a big part of, and it was really emotional for me, too.
Let's listen to the end of that video.
What makes a story great? That's for you to decide. But for me, a story that is engaging, has characters you know and enjoy, and doesn't have to end? Now that's a great story.
That's a really sweet ending and a clever analogy to the end of the book. I love the paradox that the best story is one that doesn't have to end.
Thank you. Yeah. It was an honor and a pleasure to work on this piece, and I'm really pleased with how it turned out.
Well, it's been great to have you here and to meet you. Derek Chrysler, our local media award-winning guy, cable manager, cable TV manager for the City of Ames and maker of this award-winning documentary.
So congratulations and hope to see you around. That was Derek Chrysler, whose video, The Ames Public Library, A Great Story, won Best in Show at the Best of the Midwest Video Fest. We'll have a link to that video on our website when we post the show, and we will be back with Franz Schreier, author of They Never Come Back, A Story of Undocumented Workers. He's in Ames in preparation for his Tuesday lecture at Memorial Union.
Ahora sí, ya me voy, ahí nos vemos. La frontera me voy a cruzar. Voy buscando encontrar mi camino. Voy buscando una oportunidad. Sé que voy a encontrar mis problemas. Sé que voy a tener que luchar. Pero vale el esfuerzo, la pena. Porque sé que lo voy a lograr. Y el muro de la vergüenza, por el arco del triunfo me lo voy a pasar. Y ya cuando esté en el otro lado, en su muro me voy a ir a mirar.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that explores the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. We are your hosts, Greta Anderson and Gail Seiler. That music was by the Mexican rock band El Tree, singing about El Muro, the wall that separates Mexico from the U.S.
And we've been joined in the studio by Franz Schreier, professor emeritus at the University of Guelph in Canada, where he taught in the Department of Anthropology
and Sociology.
He is author of the book titled They Never Come Back, A Story of Undocumented Workers from Mexico. Dr. Schreier will be speaking on Tuesday night in the Memorial Union at ISU. Thank you for being with us and welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start by asking you to give us just a short summary of what you're going to be talking about on Tuesday night at ISU.
Well, in my talk, I'm going to be summarizing the book, but not to give a story away, say a little bit about how I got to write a book, why I wrote a book, and a little bit about the implications of the policies that are also referred to in the book.
Okay. And how did you become interested in the experiences of undocumented Mexicans in particular in the United States?
Well, I've been working in Mexico since my early 20s, and I was involved in a community development organization. We used to come to Mexico by bus. And when I stayed in anthropology, I decided to do my research in Mexico. I thought I'd do a quick MA because I knew how to get there by bus. And before I knew it, it became my life's career. I've always worked in rural Mexico, very remote regions, where you never had any kind of migration except for people migrating to the coast to work. And I didn't work in Mexico for about 10 years. And when I went back to do my research in Mexico again in a predominantly Nahuatl-speaking, an indigenous region, I was amazed at how half the population was working as undocumented workers in the States. That wasn't my main interest. I was more interested in craft production, in change in agriculture. And one day when I met somebody, a boy in a van going to a nearby city, I was practicing, because they speak another language in this part of Mexico. They speak Nahuatl, which is the same language
an
that the
indigenous
Aztecs.
Language.
Indigenous language, mm-hmm. The same language that the Aztecs used to speak. I was practicing my Nahuatl, and he spoke Spanish, and he turned and he started speaking English. And he told me that he had been sort of adopted, or he was living with a retired school teacher. The second thing that really made me aware of the importance of undocumented workers, that phenomena, is when one day in rural Mexico I saw two little kids, a boy and a girl, who just come back with their parents for a visit. They were undocumented workers, and they were eating cornflakes and speaking English, something I'd never seen in remote parts of Mexico. So then I decided to really focus much more on the experiences of undocumented workers, and I started going, whenever I went back to Canada after my field work in Mexico, because most of my work is in Mexico, I would spend a week, 10 days, sometimes 3 weeks, in either Texas or California. And I lived with undocumented workers and got their stories. But sometimes I would learn more about the experience of somebody working in the United States as an undocumented worker from talking to someone in Mexico. And sometimes people in Mexico would tell me things about their hometown that I never learned when I was in Mexico. So it became very much, the book is very much, focuses much on the place of origin, the region where these people come from, as it is in their experience in the United States.
Yeah, and so that going back and forth, and then you also write about those left behind in Mexico. So you're an anthropologist, and the work you do is what we call ethnography.
Yes.
Can you explain what that is and how you do your work?
Well, ethnography is basically writing, telling stories about people. And ethnographers try to explain, well, the anthropologists study cultures, societies. But in order to get the point of view of the people that you study, how they see the world and what they believe, and then learning the language, tape recording, doing interviews, that's what ethnography is about. It's basically, it's writing about people, writing about people's experiences, people's history. That's a very important part of anthropology.
Mm-hmm. And your book focuses on people from a part of southwest Mexico, the area called Alta Balsas.
Yes, it's in the state of Guerrero, one of the poor states in Mexico. There's a Balsas River, and there's about 20 towns on both sides of the Balsas River. It's the Upper Balsas. They were going to make a big hydroelectric dam in 1990. Most people in this region speak a native language, Nahuatl, and Spanish as well. And they see themselves, they identify more with the town where they come from. Or they know that the use of the term indígena, which is indigenous in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And so you alluded to this earlier, and you write about it in the book, that immigration patterns between Mexico and the U.S. have changed significantly.
Yes.
And you witnessed that change.
Yes.
So let's talk about that now. What's happened and why?
Well, there's been migration from Mexico a long time back, even going back as far as the later part of the 19th century. There was no border until 1924, actually, in the United States. There was no real border, no real border control.
Really?
And people who live in the southern United States and not just in the northern part of Mexico, and the southern United States would go back and forth all the time as if there was no border.
Okay.
And all of a sudden you have a border control. And then you have the recruitment of a lot of Mexican workers, especially in the 1920s, in meatpacking firms and agriculture. And then when the recession came, a lot of those people who were deported or were sent back. They didn't need them anymore. Eventually you get with the Second World War and the need for labor and labor shortages, you have the whole program, the Bracero program. This is a documented workers who were given a contract to work mainly in agriculture. And that program stopped in 1986. The people in the region I did my research are more in central Mexico. They were not migrating at all. Maybe one man per village. There's many men that would go, had been involved in this program. But starting in 1986, with the end of the
official program.
Official program, the Bracero program, you have the beginning of undocumented workers. And for 20, 30 years, Mexico and the United States had a de facto guest worker program. They called it a revolving door. People went back and forth. People played a blind eye. Border Patrol officials never really strictly enforced people entering. And this became almost customary. As they got more and more money and more budgets to have greater border controls and to really clamp down the borders, it was more difficult to go to Mexico. You always had to pay a coyote, a human smuggler, to get you across. But it was with a lot of economic problems in Mexico, especially in the late 80s with the devaluation of the peso. Then you have the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, no longer a lot of subsidies for corn producers. Mexico developed in many ways, a lot of infrastructure, better schools, but there's very few jobs. And so more and more people became dependent. In the region where I do my research, all of a sudden everybody started going to the United States. Every single man, every single, well, young person, every person who finishes primary school or what they call television high school. This is a high school where they have a television program and a teacher explains it. They would all, 90% of them, would go to the United States. Hmm. And they all had jobs waiting for them. And they would come back and forth. But it became more and more difficult. It's easy to go back to Mexico. It's much more difficult to go back to the States again. A lot of men would go, leave their wives behind, or they would marry their high school sweetheart. And as soon as those kids got older and finished their education, they would join their fathers. Then as it became more and more difficult to go back and forth, a lot of young women wanted to join their husbands or young couples who met in the States. So more and more children are being born in the States because they didn't want to be separated, and it was much more difficult back and forth. Instead of visiting every 2 months, they would visit every 2 years, then every 10 years. And so ironically, you have a lot more people born in the United States because it became much more difficult to cross the border. So that whole dynamic changed the demographic composition. So instead of all kids being born in Mexico and eventually doing the same thing their fathers or their mothers did, you now have whole families in the States, mm-hmm. with the contradictions of children that are born in Mexico but who are not American citizens, even though they've been in the United States since they were 5 years old and they speak English, and they say, I'm an American, until I realize they apply to go to college, right. But you can't. The other part, which a lot of people aren't aware of, is everybody knows about the young people in the United States who can think they're Americans, but actually they're Mexicans. A lot of people don't know something else, another interesting phenomenon. The many, many American citizens who are born in the United States, but whose parents were either deported or who went back voluntarily, or they have been back because there's no work, who have grown up in Mexico and they speak no English, they know nothing about American history, but they're American citizens. I figure it's around 50 million of those as well.
Wow.
And so that's an example of the theme of my book is basically people's stories. I'm not arguing that people are exploited. I mean, people don't like not being paid over time, but people earn much more in the United States, even as minimum wage as undocumented workers, than they do in Mexico. The real tragedy is that people's lack of insecurity, the ambiguity, the feeling of ambivalence, and those personal feelings, which I describe in my book and many stories, are a reflection of a big contradiction. We have an increasingly more integrated North American economy between Canada, the United States, and Mexico. We don't have a free labor market. The United States has never given enough work permits. So you have millions and millions of people, especially from Mexico, flooding into the United States, and they're not allowed to work here. So they live in a shadowy world.
Mm-hmm. And then that's been made even more serious by the militarization and the clamping down at the borders, which you say used to be much more fluid.
Yes. Yeah. Although they say, the experts, in my book, they're not my original ideas. I take ideas of economists, demographers, sociologists about immigration policy, and the experts all say that if the difference in standard of living and wage is about 1 to 10, Mexico is not as bad off as other parts of the world. If it's that big, then there's no way you can avoid people trying to get work. This was true in Europe. When people from, say, southern Portugal and Spain used to go to Germany, and with the European community, and they took a long time to sort of try to standardize or try to equalize the standard of living between southern Europe and northern Europe, when the difference was about 1 to 5, all of a sudden, as many people went to Germany as people from Germany would go to Spain. But this does not happen. This did not happen in North America.
I'm curious about the what you described as kind of the origin of this problem back in 1986, and the devaluation of the Mexican peso. Was that something that was imposed by the International Monetary Fund, which is an outside, a global institution that regulates currency? It seems that a lot of these things are kind of imposed on Mexico, the NAFTA.
Yes. For a long time, Mexico, like many other countries in Latin America, have what they call a policy of import substitution. They subsidize their own industries, and that worked until about maybe the mid-80s. And there's a lot of problems with inflation. Mexico became kind of a petrol economy, so the government was able to spend a lot of money on education, but that didn't work at a certain point. They ran out of money. And with the imposition of of monetary policy that forced the government in Mexico to spend less money on social programs, and yet there wasn't the work for people to get the work they needed. And that was one of the problems with the very rapid inflation. Now, with NAFTA, with the free trade agreement, and when the value of the peso, which used to be worth millions of pesos, a huge inflation, with the fiscal reforms and changes, it became much more stable. And Mexico has developed a lot of road construction, a lot of infrastructure. Mexico has done pretty well in some ways, but again, the jobs aren't there. And all of the corn producers that used to grow corn, the subsistence cultivators, really can't make a living anymore. I say the region where people, it was like a miracle story of all of the Mexican peasants who learned how to paint on bark paintings, they're called amates, and other kinds of crafts. They invented themselves without government help, without any kind of, you know, missionaries or community development organizations. They themselves invented a new form of livelihood. They would go directly to the tourist beaches, to Mexico City, to the subway stations, and they had a boom. And they did very well. They achieved sort of almost a middle or lower middle class standard of living, from thatch roof huts to cement houses. And that boom, again, didn't work. Nowadays, younger people cannot compete with their parents. You can only have so many people selling crafts on the beach and having steady customers. So more and more young people, everybody, nobody wants to replicate what their parents did. And so in order to maintain a higher standard of living everybody had achieved in those villages where I did my research, the only way to do that is to go to the United States. And it takes you about 4 or 5 years to pay off the coyote who sneaked you across the border. But if you're very frugal and the whole family works, then after about 8 or 9 years, you can afford to build a nice house or improve the house that your parents built originally, maybe pay for your children's education in Mexico. And so people have done quite well for themselves. But there's a limit to what you can do. And that's why there's a real motivation to keep on going to.
Sure. And we had just recently had a pretty well-publicized case in Iowa of a pastor who was deported. He had been here for a number of years, had a family, and was a pastor serving a community here in Iowa. And he was deported despite a massive letter-writing campaign and so on. Can you talk a bit about, the whole idea of deportation and the implications on both sides of the border?
Okay, in terms of Mexico, very few people got deported. People sometimes came back. It was a revolving door. Actually, ironically, under Obama, his first term of office, more and more people were deported, but they were only juvenile delinquents. Anybody who makes a mistake, if you drink too much, you drink when you drive, and so you have the flooding in of a lot of young people. Most people in most families in the United States say, we're not worried about getting picked up by the migra, or being sent back to my school. If you work hard, if you're a good citizen, then we have nothing to worry about.
This was in the past.
In the past.
Yeah.
Well, even today to some extent, people still believe that as long as you behave yourself. But the problem is, the tragedy is that a lot of children, both born in Mexico and born in the United States, when they go to school, they have to come straight home to their parents' apartment or rented accommodations, and they can't go out. They feel like they're boxed in because their parents are so afraid that they might be influenced by, especially in downtown Los Angeles, by gangs. And they've seen cases of children have gone down the wrong road and have taken drugs, have gotten involved in violent crime, and they're the first people to be deported. And that's a shock for the village. All of a sudden, you have these young people come in. They don't respect the elders anymore. And they beat up the local town mayor. So that was quite a shock. And you also have many, many more people that they never come back. It's an ambiguous title. They're supposed to come back, but then they don't come back, or not as frequently as they used to in the past. Mm-hmm. But they should come back. And they do come back sometimes under less than fortunate circumstances.
It's kind of like you can't go home again.
Yep.
Your whole outlook has changed.
Yeah, people talk about, we feel like we're boxed in. We can't ever go back. People from Los Angeles visit their friends in Sacramento, but they never go south of Los Angeles because there's so many border patrols that you're more likely to run into trouble with the law.
Yeah. As a professor in Canada, does a Canadian perspective shape how you see these things? I mean, it's interesting that you're doing this work that's mainly involving Mexico and the U.S., but you bring a Canadian perspective to it.
Well, a Canadian perspective in the fact that I was born and raised and was educated in the Netherlands, in Holland. My parents emigrated to Canada. That's another kind of perspective. because I grew up in a country where every country had its own borders, own money, and then you had the European community, which took a long time to plan. And finally, it's had some problems right now, but that to me was an ideal solution for a while. It's very easy to very be smug in Canada to say, well, we have a great immigration policy. In terms of workers, especially in agriculture, you have a guest workers program. But it's very limited to agriculture. The Canadian government actually wanted to set a good example. And they started opening up a program for guest workers from the Caribbean and then from Mexico. And that's become a very popular program. There are some problems with it. Individual family farmers get to know their workers, become friends. Larger operations, greenhouse operations, you often could have a nice Spanish-speaking supervisor, and there have been complaints and problems. The problem with Canada, even though it had a much more generous immigration policy, is that if you're undocumented, there are undocumented workers and families in construction, a lot of Portuguese, for instance, it's actually worse than if you're in the States. Because there's much fewer of them, but you fall between the cracks. Because in the United States, if you're an undocumented worker, if it's an emergency and your baby is sick, you can still take it to the hospital, and some doctor will still give you medical attention. In some ways, it's even more difficult for undocumented. There aren't as many of them. So it's very easy to criticize the United States because I think you have a very dysfunctional immigration policy. The hypocrisy of having so many people between 10 and 30 or 20 million, whatever the estimate is, of undocumented workers, and the economy needs them.
Right, yeah. And yet there's not a system in place to make that work. So the word dysfunctional is commonly used.
Yeah. It's used by all the experts, all the economists, all the demographers.
Yeah. So obviously there are political reasons why we can't seem to agree on how to fix this dysfunctional system. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I used to be quite an optimist. I'm becoming more pessimistic. You also have a somewhat dysfunctional political system with two political parties that can never agree. And if the Bush, who has relatives in Mexico, wanted to set up a sort of an amnesty program, his own Republican Party wouldn't allow him. When there was a bipartisan agreement in the House of Senate about a year ago about both a combination of amnesty or the equivalent of amnesty, the documentation of undocumented workers and a guest worker program or something equivalent to the old Balseda program, it was shot down in the Congress. Obama has made a lot of decisions.
Presidential orders,
but they only go so far. If it isn't implemented systematically throughout the whole system, it's not going to work. Also, even though I think he means well, if you have legalization of undocumented workers, but you don't have a good guest workers program, if you make the border even more militarized and prevent all these people from coming across, that's not going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. The village where one of the towns that I know the best, where I spent a lot of time, up until 3 years ago, if 23 students graduated from school, almost all of them, 22, would go to the States, two wouldn't get across, the rest would. They had a big shock. About 4 or 5 years ago, only two people made it across with the militarization, increasing, more rigid border controls. The coyotes, the human smugglers, have a bad reputation. In fact, they're quite professional. They actually know their job. They charge a lot of money. It now costs $4,000. Which is a lot of money in Mexico to come to the States. $7,000 if you come from Guatemala. The drug cartels in Mexico itself has become very dysfunctional with the rival drug cartels and government trying to clamp down. They're getting the business of human smuggling. And so all of a sudden, that plus the border controls makes it more and more difficult to find a coyote or to get across the border. All of a sudden, 2 years later, the economy's picked up. In the town that I know, all of a sudden, for the first time, people are getting across again under a new phenomenon called the coyota. That's a woman, coyote. Mm-hmm. There are women who basically smuggle across relatives and friends, people are recommended. They still charge a lot of money, $4,000, but at least they now in this town guarantee that if you don't come across the first time, there'll be civil rights activists, lawyers, they'll help you get out of jail. You won't be detained for more than a month before you're deported, and you come across again the second time you come across.
That's fascinating. How does it benefit to have a woman coyote? What is the advantage?
There's a lot more trust. I think they're a little bit more, I won't say more professional, but certainly more ethical.
They're less likely to be involved in the drug trade?
Oh, no. I see no evidence of them being involved in the drug trade. Uh-huh. And I don't think the drug cartels have sort of figured it out yet. They don't know yet. But this might only happen for a little while. Who knows?
So what do you think the prospects are for change, for things to improve? You said you are becoming more pessimistic.
One of the reasons I wrote my book is I've written lots of books on anthropologists, more scientific or professional books, and there's something called public anthropology, which means writing to a broader audience to influence public policy. And there's a need, I think, for more of the larger percentage of American population through their voting, through their political action, to maybe try to bring about changes that are more comprehensive and are better than what's happening right now.
I like that idea, public anthropology. And so your talk tomorrow night, Tuesday night, at the Memorial Union on ISU campus will contribute to that. That's wonderful. I think that we're going to wrap it up with that. Thanks very much for being here today. We've been talking with Dr. Franz Schreier, professor emeritus at the University of Guelph in Canada and author of They Never Come Back, A Story of Undocumented Workers from Mexico. If you want to learn more about the challenges, opportunities, and hardships facing undocumented immigrants in the U.S. and those left behind, you can hear him speak tomorrow, Tuesday, at 7 p.m. in the Memorial Union.
We have a postscript to our show two Fridays ago on GMOs and Vandana Shiva's talk, other lectures and events that are coming up at ISU in relation to that. Two of them are going to occur on Wednesday, March 25th. The first is at 7 p.m., GMO Technology, the Future of Food, by Kevin Folta in Curtis Hall. Kevin Folta is a professor and chair of the Horticulture Sciences at the University of Florida, who runs a website to help scientists learn the facts about biotechnology and then better communicate them. So this would be quite the opposite view to that of Vandana Shiva. Also on Wednesday night at 8 p.m. is the forum on transgenic bananas that our guest Angie Carter told us about. It's a dialogue on the ethics, impacts, and alternatives to this transgenic bananas research, and that will be in Memorial Union at 8.
And Dr. Shiva's lecture will air on KHOI on the Heart of Iowa at noon and 7 p.m. this Thursday, March 26th. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We've been your hosts, Gail Seiler and Greta Anderson. Rick Morrison has been our engineer.
Our guests were Linda Hansen, Clinic Director of Primary Healthcare in Ames, which is having an open house on Thursday, 5 to 6:30, at its new West Lincoln Way office. We also spoke with Derek Krizler, Ames Cable TV manager who won a Best in Show at the Best of the Midwest Video Fest last week for his 16-minute video, Ames Public Library, A Great Story.
And finally, we spoke with Franz Schreier, an anthropologist and professor at the University of Guelph and author of a book about undocumented workers from Mexico. You can hear him Tuesday in Memorial Union at 7 p.m.
Links to all of this information will appear on our website, khoifm.org, just as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get to it.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team, call us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or email us through our website, khoifm.org.
As always, your participation as audience and your generous donations are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Para que hagan pedazos con ella, mientras yo les canto esta canción.